to play was honesty, as Rob Park put it. Brad argued to his bosses that he should be permitted to launch what amounted to a public information campaign. He wanted to go out and explain to anyone with money to invest in the United States stock markets that they were now the prey. He wanted to tell them about this new weapon they might use to defend themselves from the predator. But the market was already pressuring him to say nothing at all. He was in a race to win a debate in front of RBC's top management about how to respond to the newly automated stock markets. All he had going for him was his weird discovery, which proved... what, exactly? That the stock market now behaved strangely, except when it didn't? The RBC executives who wanted to join forces with high-frequency traders knew as little about high-frequency trading as he did. I needed someone from the industry to verify that what I was saying was real, said Brad. He needed specifically someone from deep inside the world of high-frequency trading. He'd spent the better part of a year cold-calling strangers in search of an HFT strategist willing to defect. He now suspected that every human being who knew how high-frequency traders made money was making too much money doing it to stop and explain what was going on. He needed to find another way in. Chapter 3. Ronan's Problem. Part of Ronan's problem was that he didn't look like a Wall Street trader. He had pale skin and narrow, stooped shoulders, and the uneasy caution of a man who has survived one potato famine and is expecting another. He also lacked the Wall Street trader's ability to bury his self-doubt and to seem more important and knowledgeable than he actually was. He was wiry and wary, like a mongoose. And yet from the moment he caught his first glimpse of a Wall Street trading floor in his early 20s, Ronan Ryan badly wanted to work on Wall Street and couldn't understand why he didn't belong. It's hard not to get enamored of being one of these Wall Street guys who people are scared of and make all this money, he said. But it was hard to imagine anyone being scared of Ronan. The other part of Ronan's problem was his inability or unwillingness to disguise his modest origins. Born and raised in Dublin, he had moved to America in 1990 when he was 16. The Irish government had sent his father to New York to talk American companies into moving to Ireland for the tax benefits, but few imagined that they would do so. Ireland was poor and dreary, kind of like a shithole, to be honest. His father, who was not made of money, had spent every last penny he had to rent a house in Greenwich, Connecticut, so that Ronan might attend the Greenwich Public High School and see what life was like on the right side of the tracks. "I couldn't believe it," says Ronan. "The kids had their own cars at 16. Kids would complain they had to ride on a school bus. I'd say, this fucking thing actually takes you to school, and it's free. I used to walk 3 miles. It's hard not to love America." When Ronan was 22, his father was recalled to Ireland. Ronan stayed behind. He didn't think of Ireland as a place anyone would ever go back to if given the choice, and he had now embraced his idea of the American dream, Greenwich, Connecticut version. The year before, through an Irish guy his father had met, he'd landed a summer internship in the back office at Chemical Bank and had been promised a place in the management training program. Then they canceled the training program. The Irish guy vanished. Graduating from Fairfield University in 1996, he sent letters to all the Wall Street banks, but received just one false flicker of interest from what, even to his untrained eyes, was a vaguely criminal pump-and-dump penny stock brokerage firm. "It's not as easy as you think to get a job on Wall Street," he said. "I didn't know anyone. My family had no contacts whatsoever. We knew no one." Eventually, he gave up trying. He met another Irish guy who happened to work in the New York office of MCI Communications, the big telecom company. "He gave me a job strictly because I was Irish," said Ronan. "I guess he had a few charity cases a year. I was one of them." For no particular reason, other than that no one else would hire him, he went to work in the telecom industry. The first big job they gave him was to make sure that the 8,000 new pagers MCI had sold to a big Wall Street firm were well received. As he was told, people are really sensitive about their pagers. Ronan traveled in the back of a repair truck in the summer heat to some office building to deliver the new pagers. He set up his little table at the back of the truck and unpacked the crates and waited for the Wall Street people to come and get their new pagers. An hour into it, he was sweating and huffing inside the truck while a line of people waited for their pagers, and a crowd had formed of guys to whom he'd already given the pagers, pager protesters.
"These new pagers suck," and "I hate this fucking pager," they screamed, as he tried to pass out even more pagers.
As he dealt with the revolt, one of the Wall Street firm's secretaries called him about her boss's new pager. She was so despondent about the thing that Ronan thought he could hear her crying. "She keeps saying over and over, 'It's too big. It's gonna really hurt him. It's too big. It's gonna really hurt him.'" Ronan was now totally confused. How could a pager inflict harm on a grown man? It was a tiny box, an inch by an inch and a half. "Then she tells me he's a midget, and it would dig into his side when he bent over," said Ronan. "And that he wasn't like a normal-sized midget. He was a really small dude." And I'm thinking, but I don't say it because I don't want her to think I'm a dick. Why don't you just strap it onto his back like a backpack? At that moment, and others like it, many things crossed Ronan's mind that he did not say. Sizing pagers to little Wall Street people and being hollered at by big Wall Street people who didn't like their new gadgets was not what he had imagined doing with his life. He was upset he hadn't found a path onto Wall Street. He decided to make the best of it. That turned out to be the view that MCI offered him of the entire U.S. telecom system. Ronan had always been handy, but he had never actually studied anything practical. He knew next to nothing about technology. Now he started to learn all about it. "It's pretty captivating, when you take the nerdiness out of it, how this shit works," he said. "How a copper circuit conveyed information compared to a glass fiber. How a switch made by Cisco compared to a switch made by Juniper. Which hardware companies made the fastest computer equipment, and which buildings in which cities contained floors that could withstand the weight of that equipment, old manufacturing buildings, were best." He also learned how information actually traveled from one place to another, which was usually not in a straight line run by a single telecom carrier, but in a convoluted path run by several. "When you make a call to New York from Florida, you have no idea how many pieces of equipment you have to go through for that call to happen. You probably just think it's fucking like two cans and a piece of string, but it's not. A circuit that connected New York City to Florida would have Verizon on the New York end, Bell South on the Florida end, and MCI in the middle. It would zigzag from population center to population center. Once it got there, it would wind in all sorts of crazy ways through skyscrapers and city streets. To sound knowing, telecom people like to say that their fiber routes ran through the NFL cities. That was another thing Ronan learned. A lot of people in and around the telecom industry were more knowing than knowledgeable. The people at MCI who sold the technology often didn't actually understand it, and yet were paid far better than people like him who simply fixed problems. Or, as he put it, "I'm making 35, and they're making a buck 20, and they're fucking idiots." He got himself moved to sales and became a leading salesperson. A few years into the job, he was lured from MCI by Quest Communications. 3 years later, he was lured from Quest by another big telecom carrier, Level 3. He was now making good money, a couple of hundred grand a year. By 2005, he also couldn't help but notice his clients were more likely than ever to be big Wall Street banks. He spent entire weeks inside Goldman Sachs and Lehman Brothers and Deutsche Bank, figuring out the best routes to run fiber and the best machines to hook that fiber up to. He hadn't lost his original ambition. At some point on every Wall Street job he had, he'd nose around for a job opening. I'm thinking, I'm meeting so many people, why can't I get a job at one of these places? Actually, the big banks offered him jobs all the time, but the jobs were never finance jobs. They offered him tech jobs, working in some remote site with computer hardware and fiber optic cable. There was a vividly clear class distinction between tech guys and finance guys. The finance guys saw the tech guys as faceless help and were unable to think of them as anything else. They always said the same thing to me. "You're a boxes and lines guy," he said. Then in 2006, B.T. Radians called. Radians was born of 9/11, after the attacks on the World Trade Center knocked out big pieces of Wall Street's communication system. The company promised to build for big Wall Street banks a system less vulnerable to outside attack than the existing system. Ronan's job was to sell the financial world on the idea of subcontracting their information networks to Radians. In particular, he was meant to sell the banks on co-locating their computers in Radian's data center in Nutley, New Jersey. But not long after he started his job at Radian's, Ronan had a different sort of inquiry from a hedge fund based in Kansas City. The caller said he worked at a stock market trading firm called Bountiful Trust, and that he had heard Ronan was expert at moving financial data from one place to another. Bountiful Trust had a problem. In making trades between Kansas City and New York, it took them too long to determine what happened to their orders, that is, what stocks they had bought and sold. They also noticed that increasingly, when they placed their orders, the market was vanishing on them, just as it was vanishing on Brad Katsuyama. He says, "My latency time is 43 milliseconds, recalls Ronan. And I said, "What the hell is a millisecond?" Latency was simply the time between the moment a signal was sent and when it was received. There were several factors that determined the latency of a stock market trading system: the boxes, the logic, and the lines. The boxes were the machinery the signals passed through on their way from point A to point B, the computer servers and signal amplifiers and switches. The logic was the software, the code instructions that operated the boxes. Ronan didn't know much about software, except that more and more it seemed to be written by Russian guys who barely spoke English. The lines were the glass fiber-optic cables that carried the information from one box to another. The single biggest determinant of speed was the length of the fiber, or the distance the signal needed to travel to get from point A to point B. Ronan didn't know what a millisecond was, but he understood the problem with this Kansas City hedge fund. It was in Kansas City. Light in a vacuum traveled at 186,000 miles per second, or put another way, 186 miles a millisecond. Light inside of fiber bounced off the walls and so traveled at only about two-thirds of its theoretical speed, but it was still fast. The biggest enemy of the speed of a signal was the distance the signal needed to travel. "Physics is physics. This is what the traders didn't understand," said Ronan. The whole reason Bountiful Trust had set up shop in Kansas City was that its founders believed that it no longer mattered where they were physically located, that Wall Street was no longer a place. They were wrong. Wall Street was, once again, a place. It wasn't actually on Wall Street now. It was in New Jersey. Ronan moved the computers from Kansas City to Radian's data center in Nutley and reduced the time it took them to find out what they had bought and sold from 43 milliseconds to 3.8 milliseconds. From that moment, the demand on Wall Street for Ronan's services intensified. Not just from banks and well-known high-frequency trading firms, but also from prop shops, proprietary trading firms no one had ever heard of, with just a few guys in them. All wanted to be able to trade faster than the others. To be faster, they needed to find shorter routes for their signals to travel. To be faster, they needed the newest hardware, stripped down to its essentials. To be faster, they also needed to reduce the physical distance between their computers and the computers inside the various stock exchanges. Ronan knew how to solve all of these problems, but as all his new customers housed their computers inside the Radian's data center in Nutley, this was a tricky business. Ronan says, "One day a trader calls and asks, 'Where am I in the room?' I'm thinking, 'In the room? What do you mean, in the room?' What the guy meant, it turned out, was in the room. He was willing to pay to move his computer that sent orders into the stock market as close as possible to the pipe that exited the building in Nutley so that he would have a slight jump on the other computers in the room. Another trader then called Ronan to say that he had noticed that his fiber optic cable was a few yards longer than it needed to be. Instead of having it wind around the outside of the room with everyone else's cable, which helped to reduce the heat in the room, the trader wanted his cable to hew a straight line right across the middle of the room. It was only a matter of time before the stock exchanges figured out that if people were willing to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to move their machines around inside some remote data center, just so they might be a tiny bit closer to the stock exchange, they'd pay millions to be inside the stock exchange itself. Ronan followed them there. He came up with an idea. Sell proximity to Wall Street as a service. Call it Proximity Services. "We tried to trademark proximity, but you can't because it's a word," he said. What he wanted to call proximity soon became known as co-location, and Ronan became the world's authority on the subject. When they ran out of ways to reduce the length of their cable, they began to focus on the devices on either end of the cable, data switches, for instance. The difference between fast data switches and slow ones was measured in microseconds, millionths of a second, but microseconds were now critical. One guy says to me, "It doesn't matter if I'm 1 second slower or 1 microsecond. Either way, I come in second place." The switching times fell from 150 microseconds to 1.2 microseconds per trade. "And then," says Ronan, "they started to ask, 'What kind of glass are you using?' All optical fibers were not created equal. Some kinds of glass conveyed light signals more efficiently than others, and Ronan thought, never before in human history have people gone to so much trouble and spent so much money to gain so little speed. People were measuring the length of their cables to the foot inside the exchanges. People were buying these servers and chucking them out 6 months later, for microseconds. He didn't know how much money high-frequency traders were making, but he could guess from how much they were spending. From the end of 2005 to the end of 2008, Radians alone billed them nearly $80 million, just for setting up their computers near the stock exchange matching engines. And Radians was hardly the only one billing them. Seeing that the fiber routes between the New Jersey exchanges were often less than ideal, Ronan prodded a company called Hudson Fiber into finding straighter ones. Hudson Fiber was now doing a land office business, digging trenches in places that would give Tony Soprano pause. Ronan could only guess how much money high-frequency traders were making by the trouble they took to conceal how they made it. One HFT firm he set up inside one of the stock exchanges insisted that he wrap their new computer servers in wire gauze to prevent anyone from seeing their blinking lights or improvements in their hardware. Another HFT firm secured the computer cage nearest the exchange's matching engine, the computer code that in fact was now the stock market. Formerly owned by Toys R Us, the computers probably ran the toy store's website, the cage was emblazoned with store logos. The HFT firm insisted on leaving the Toys R Us logos in place so that no one would know they had improved their position in relation to the matching engine by several feet. "They were all paranoid," said Ronan, "but they were right to be. If you know how to pickpocket someone and you were the pickpocketer, you would do the same thing. You'd see someone find a new switch that was 3 microseconds faster, and in 2 weeks, everyone in the data center would have the same switch." By the end of 2007, Ronan was making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year building systems to make stock market trades faster. He was struck over and over again by how little the traders he helped understood of the technology they were using. They'd say, "Aha, I saw it. It's so fast." And I'd say, "Look, I'm happy you like our product, but there's no fucking way you saw anything." And they're like, "I saw it." And I'm like, "It's 3 milliseconds. It's 50 times faster than the blink of an eye." He was also keenly aware that he had only the faintest idea of the reason for this incredible new lust for speed. He heard a lot of loose talk about arbitrage, but what exactly was being arbitraged, and why did it need to be done so fast? "I felt like the getaway driver," he said. "Each time it was like, drive faster, drive faster. Then it was like, get rid of the airbags. Then it was, get rid of the fucking seats." Towards the end, I'm like, "Excuse me, sirs, but what are you doing in the bank?" He had a sense of the technological aptitude of the various players. The two biggest high-frequency trading firms, Citadel and Getco, were easily the smartest. Some of the prop shops were smart, too. The big banks, at least for now, were all slow. Beyond that, he didn't even really know much about his clients. The big banks, Goldman Sachs, Credit Suisse, everyone had heard of. Others, Citadel, Getco, were famous on a small scale. He learned that some of these firms were hedge funds, which meant that they took money from outside investors. But most of them were prop shops, trading only their own founders' money. A huge number of the firms he dealt with, Hudson River Trading, Eagle 7, Simplex Investments, Evolution Financial Technologies, Cooper Fund, DRW, no one had ever heard of, and the firms obviously intended to keep it that way. The prop shops were especially strange because they were both transient and prosperous. They'd be just 5 guys in a room, all of them geeks. The leader of each 5-man pack is just an arrogant version of that geek, a fucking arrogant version of that. One day a prop shop was trading, the next it had closed, and all the people in it had moved to work for some big Wall Street bank. One group of guys Ronan saw over and over, 4 Russian, 1 Chinese. The arrogant Russian guy, who was clearly their leader, was named Vladimir. Vladimir and his boys ping-ponged from prop shop to big bank and back to prop shop, writing the computer code that made the actual stock market trading decisions. Ronan watched them meet with one of the most senior guys at a big Wall Street bank that hoped to employ them, and the Wall Street big shot sucked up to them. He walks into the meeting and says, "I'm always the most important man in the room, but in this case, Vladimir is." Ronan knew that these roving bands of geeks felt nothing but condescension toward the less technical guys who ran the big Wall Street firms. I was listening to them talk about some calculation they had been asked to make, and Vladimir goes, "Ho, ho, ho. That's what Americans call math." He said it like moth. "That's what Americans call moth." I thought, I'm fucking Irish, but fuck you guys. This country gave you a shot. By early 2008, Ronan was spending a lot of his time abroad, helping high-frequency traders exploit the Americanization of foreign stock markets. A pattern emerged. A country in which the stock market had always traded on a single exchange, Canada, Australia, the UK, would, in the name of free market competition, permit the creation of a new exchange. The new exchange was always located at some surprising distance from the original exchange. In Toronto, it was inside an old department store building across the city from the Toronto Stock Exchange. In Australia, it was mysteriously located not in the Sydney Financial District, but across Sydney Harbour, in the middle of a residential district. The old London Stock Exchange was in central London. BATS created a British rival in the Docklands. NYSE created another, outside of London, in Basildon. And Chi-X created a third in Slough. Each new exchange gave rise to the need for high-speed routes between the exchanges. It was almost like they picked places to set up exchanges so that the market would fragment, said Ronan. He still didn't have a job on Wall Street, but Ronan had every reason to be pleased with himself and with his career. In 2007, the first year of the speed boom, he had made $486,000, nearly twice as much as he had ever made. Yet he did not feel pleased with himself or with his career. He was obviously good at what he did, but he had no idea why he was doing it, and he wanted to. At the end of 2007, on New Year's Eve, he found himself sitting in a pub in Liverpool with Let It Be playing dully on the radio. His wife had given him the trip as this lovely gift. Around a miniature soccer ball, she'd wrapped a note that said she'd bought him a plane ticket to England and a ticket to see his favorite football team. "I'm doing something I always dreamed about doing, and it was about the most depressing moment I've ever had in my life," said Ronan. "I'm 34 years old. I'm thinking it's never going to get any better. I'm going to be fucking Willie Loman for the rest of my life." He felt ordinary. In the fall of 2009, out of the blue, the Royal Bank of Canada called him and invited him to interview for a job. He was more than a little wary. He'd barely heard of RBC, and when he checked out their website, it told him next to nothing. He'd grown weary of self-important Wall Street traders who wanted him to do their manual labor for them. I said, "I mean no disrespect, but if you're calling to offer me some tech job, I have no fucking interest." The RBC guy who called him, Brad Katsuyama, insisted that it wasn't a tech job, but a job in finance on a trading floor. Ronan met Brad at 7 the next morning, and wondered if that was a Wall Street thing, hauling people in for interviews at 7 in the morning. Brad asked him a bunch of questions and then invited him back to meet his bosses. In what seemed to Ronan like the quickest hiring in the history of Wall Street, RBC offered him a job on the trading floor. It paid $125,000, or roughly a third of what Ronan was making peddling speed to high-frequency traders. It came with a fancy title, Head of High Frequency Trading Strategies. For a chance to work on a Wall Street trading floor, Ronan was willing to take a big pay cut. "To be honest, I would have taken less," he said. But the title disturbed him, because as he put it, "I didn't know any high frequency trading strategies." He was so excited to have finally landed a job on a Wall Street trading floor that he didn't bother to ask the obvious question. His wife asked it for him. She says to me, "What are you going to do for them?" And I realized I didn't really fucking know. I really, honest to God, have no idea what the job is. There was no job description ever discussed. He never told me what he wanted me for. In the fall of 2009, an article in a trade magazine caught Brad Katsuyama's eye. He'd spent the better part of a year trying and failing to find anyone who actually worked in what was now regularly referred to as high-frequency trading, who was willing to explain to him how he made his money. The article claimed that HFT technologists were unhappy with the widening gulf in pay between themselves and the senior trading strategists of their firms, some of whom were rumored to be taking home hundreds of millions of dollars a year. He went looking for one of these unhappy technologists. The very first call he made to a guy at Deutsche Bank who dealt often with HFT gave him two names. Ronan's was the first. In his interview, Ronan described to Brad what he had witnessed inside the exchanges, the frantic competition for nanoseconds, the Toys R Us cage, the wire gauze, the war for space within the exchanges, the tens of millions being spent by high-frequency traders for tiny increments of speed. As he spoke, he filled huge empty tracks on Brad's mental map of the financial markets. What he said told me that we needed to care about microseconds and nanoseconds, said Brad. The U.S. stock market was now a class system rooted in speed of haves and have-nots. The haves paid for nanoseconds. The have-nots had no idea that a nanosecond had value. The haves enjoyed a perfect view of the market. The have-nots never saw the market at all. What had once been the world's most public, most democratic, financial market had become in spirit something more like a private viewing of a stolen work of art. I learned more from talking to him in an hour than I learned from 6 months of reading about HFT, said Brad. The second I met him, I wanted to hire him. He wanted to hire him without being able to fully explain to his bosses or even to Ronan what he wanted to hire him for. He couldn't very well call him vice president in charge of explaining to my clueless superiors why high-frequency trading is a travesty. So he called him head of high-frequency trading strategies. I felt he needed a head of title, said Brad, to get more respect from people. That was Brad's main concern, that people on the trading floor, even at RBC, would take one look at Ronan and see a guy in a yellow jumpsuit who just emerged from some manhole. Ronan didn't even pretend to know what happened on a trading floor. He had questions that were unbelievably rudimentary, but that were necessary, said Brad. He didn't know what bid and offer was. He didn't know what it meant to cross the spread. On the side, without making a big deal of it, Brad started to teach Ronan the language of trading. A bid was an attempt to buy stock, an offer an attempt to sell it. To cross the spread, if you were selling, meant to accept the bidder's price, or, if you were buying, the offering price. This fucking guy didn't laugh at me, said Ronan. He sat down and explained it. That was their private deal. Brad would teach Ronan about trading, and Ronan would teach Brad about technology. Right away, there was something to teach. Brad and his team were having trouble turning Thor into a product they could sell to investors. The investors they'd told about their discovery were clearly eager to buy Thor and use it for themselves. T. Rowe Price's Gitlin had more or less tried to buy it on the spot. But Thor now had its problems. The experiment of arriving at the exchanges at the same time had worked perfectly the first time. It proved hard to repeat, because it was difficult to coax 13 light signals to arrive in 13 different stock exchanges spread across northern New Jersey within 350 microseconds of each other, or roughly 100 microseconds less than the time they had calculated it would take some high-speed trader to front-run their order. They had succeeded the first time by estimating the differences in travel time it took to send the messages to the various exchanges, and by building the equivalent delays into their software. But the travel times were never the same. They had no control over the path the signals took to get to the exchanges, or how much traffic was on the network. Sometimes it took 4 milliseconds for their stock market orders to arrive at the New York Stock Exchange. Other times it took 7 milliseconds. When the travel time differed from their guesses of what it would be, the market once again vanished. In short, Thor was inconsistent. And it was inconsistent, Ronan explained, because the paths the electronic signals took from Brad's desk to the various exchanges were inconsistent. Ronan could see that these traders hadn't thought much about the physical process by which their signals traveled to the New Jersey stock exchanges. I realized very quickly, he said, and they'll admit this, so I mean no disrespect, that they had no fucking clue what they were doing. The signal sent from Brad's desk arrived at the New Jersey exchanges at different times because some exchanges were farther from Brad's desk than others. The fastest any high-speed trader's signal could travel from the first exchange it reached to the next one was 465 microseconds, or 1/200th of the time it takes to blink your eye, if you have a talent for it. That is, for Brad's trading orders to interact with the market as displayed on his trading screens, they needed to arrive at all the exchanges within a 465-microsecond window. The only way to do that, Ronan told his new colleagues at RBC, was to build and control your own fiber network. To make his point, Ronan brought in oversized maps of New Jersey showing the fiber optic networks built by telecom companies. On the maps, you could see just how a signal traveled from Brad's trading station at One Liberty Plaza to the exchanges. When he unrolled his first map, a guy who worked in RBC's network support team burst out, "How the fuck did you get those? They're telecom property. They're proprietary." Ronan explained, "When they said they wouldn't give them to me because they were proprietary, I said, well, then proprietarily fuck off." The high-frequency traders were paying the telecom carriers too much to be denied whatever they wanted, and Ronan had been the agent of their desires. "These maps are like fucking gold," he said. "But I had brought them so much business that they would let me see inside their freaking wife's underwear drawer if I asked them to." The maps told a story. Any trading signal that originated in Lower Manhattan traveled up the West Side Highway and out the Lincoln Tunnel. Perched immediately outside the tunnel in Weehawken, New Jersey, was the Bats Exchange. From Bats, the routes became more complicated as they had to find their way through the clutter of the Jersey suburbs. "New Jersey is now carved up like a Thanksgiving turkey," said Ronan. One way or another, they traveled east to Secaucus, the location of the Direct Edge family of exchanges founded by Goldman Sachs and Citadel, and south to the NASDAQ family of exchanges in Carteret. The New York Stock Exchange further complicated the story. In early 2010, NYSE still had its computer servers in Lower Manhattan at 55 Water Street. They moved them to distant Mahwah, New Jersey, that August. As it was less than a mile from Brad's desk, NYSE appeared to be the stock market closest to him. But Ronan's map showed the incredible indirection of optic fiber in Manhattan. To get from Liberty Plaza to 55 Water Street, you might go through Brooklyn, he explained. You can go 50 miles to get from Midtown to downtown. To get from a building to a building across the street, you could travel 15 miles. It was a 10-minute walk from RBC's office at Liberty Plaza to the New York Stock Exchange. But from a computer's point of view, the New York Stock Exchange was further from RBC's offices than Carteret. To Brad, the maps explained, among other things, why the market on Bats had proved so accurate. The reason they were always able to buy or sell 100% of the shares listed on Bats was that Bats was always the first stock market to receive their orders. News of their buying and selling hadn't had time to spread throughout the marketplace. I was like, holy shit, Bats is just closest to us. It's right outside the freaking tunnel. Inside Bats, high-frequency trading firms were waiting for news that they could use to trade on the other exchanges. They obtained that news by placing very small bids and offers, typically for 100 shares for every listed stock. Having gleaned that there was a buyer or seller of Company X's shares, they would race ahead to the other exchanges and buy or sell accordingly. The race they needed to win was not a race against the ordinary investor, who had no clue what was happening to him, but against other high-speed traders. The orders resting on Bats were typically just the 100-share minimum required for an order to be at the front of any price queue, as their only purpose was to tease information out of investors. The HFT firms posted these tiny orders on Bats, orders to buy or sell 100 shares of basically every stock traded in the U.S. market, not because they actually wanted to buy and sell the stocks, but because they wanted to find out what investors wanted to buy and sell before they did it. Bats, unsurprisingly, had been created by high-frequency traders. The funny thing was that a lot of what Ronan had seen and heard didn't make sense to him. He didn't know what he knew. Brad now helped him to understand. For instance, Ronan had noticed the HFT guys creating elaborate tables of the time measured in microseconds it took for a stock market order to travel from any given brokerage house to each of the exchanges. Latency tables, these were called. The times were subtly different for each brokerage house. They depended upon where the brokerage house physically was located and which fiber networks, at least in New Jersey. These tables took trouble to create and were of obvious value to high-frequency traders, but Ronan had no idea why. This was the first Brad had heard of latency tables, but he knew exactly why they had been created. They enabled high-frequency traders to identify brokers by the time their orders took to travel from one exchange to the other. Once you had figured out which broker was behind any given stock market order, you could discern patterns in each broker's behavior. If you knew which broker had just come into the market with an order to buy 1,000 shares of IBM, you might further guess whether those 1,000 shares were the entire order or a part of a much larger order. You might also guess how the broker might distribute the order among the various exchanges, and how much above the current market price for IBM shares the broker might be willing to pay. The HFT guys didn't need perfect information to make riskless profits. They only needed to skew the odds systematically in their favor. But, as Brad put it, what you're looking for ultimately is large brokers who are behaving idiotically with their customers' orders. That's the real gold mine. He also knew that Wall Street brokers had a new incentive to behave idiotically, because he had himself succumbed to the temptation. When Wall Street decided where to route their clients' stock market orders, they were now greatly influenced by the new system of kickbacks paid and fees charged to them by the exchanges. If a big Wall Street broker stood to be paid to send an order to buy 10,000 shares of IBM to Bats, but was charged to send the same order to the New York Stock Exchange, it would program its routers to send the customer's order to Bats. The router, designed by human beings, took on a life of its own. Along with the trading algorithms, the routers were a critical piece of technology in the automated stock markets. Both are designed and built by people who work for the Wall Street broker. Both do the thinking that people used to do, but the intellectual tasks they perform are different. The algorithm does its thinking first. It decides how to slice up any given order. Say you want to buy 100,000 shares of XYZ company at no more than $25 a share when the market shows a total of 2,000 shares offered at $25. To simply attempt to buy 100,000 shares all at once would create havoc in the market and drive the price higher. The algorithm decides how many shares you buy, when to buy them, and the price to pay. For example, it may instruct the router to carve the 100,000 share order into 20 pieces and to buy 5,000 shares every 5 minutes, so long as the price is no higher than $25. The router determines where the order is sent. For instance, a router might instruct the order to go first to a Wall Street firm's dark pool before going to the exchanges. Or it might instruct the order to go first to any exchange that will pay the broker to trade, and only then to exchanges on which the broker will be compelled to pay to trade. This is a so-called sequential cost-effective router. To illustrate how stupid routing can be, say you've told your Wall Street broker, to whom you are paying a commission, that you wish to buy 100,000 shares of company XYZ at $25, and now, conveniently, there are 100,000 shares for sale at $25, 10,000 on each of 10 different exchanges, all of which will charge the broker to trade on your behalf, though far less than the commission you have paid to him. There are, however, another 100 shares for sale, also at $25, on the BATS exchange, which will pay the broker for the trade. The sequential cost-effective router will go first to BATS and buy the 100 shares, and cause the other 100,000 shares to vanish into the paws of high-frequency traders, in the bargain relieving the broker of the obligation to pay to trade. The high-frequency traders can then turn around and sell the shares of company XYZ at a higher price, or hold on to the shares for a few seconds more while you, the investor, chase company XYZ's shares even higher. In either case, the result is unappealing to the original buyer of company XYZ's shares. That is but the most obvious of many examples of routing stupidity. The customer, you or someone investing on your behalf, is typically entirely oblivious to the inner workings of both algorithms and routers. Even if he demanded to know how his order was routed and his broker told him, he would never be sure what was said was true, as he has no sufficiently detailed record of what shares traded and when they traded. The broker's routers, like bad poker players, all had a conspicuous tell. The tell might be a glitch in their machines rather than a twitch of their facial muscles, but it was just as valuable to the HFT guys on the other side of the table. Once Brad had explained all of this to Ronan, he didn't need to explain it again. "It was, oh shit, some of the things I overheard now make more sense," said Ronan. With Ronan's help, the RBC team designed their own fiber network and turned Thor into a product that could be sold to investors. The sales pitch was absurdly simple. There is a new predator in the financial markets. Here is how he operates. And we have a weapon you can use to defend yourself against him. The argument about whether RBC should leap into bed with high-frequency traders ended. Brad's new problem was spreading the word of what he now knew to the U.S. investing public. Seeing how shocked people were by what Ronan had to say, and how interested they were in it, and no longer needing Ronan to persuade his bosses that something strange and new was afoot, Brad decided to set Ronan loose on Wall Street's biggest customers. Brad calls me in and says, "What if we stop calling you head of high-frequency trading strategy and make you head of electronic trading strategy?" said Ronan, who had no idea what either title actually meant. I called my wife and said, "I think they just promoted me." A few days later, Ronan went with Brad to his first Wall Street meeting. Right before the meeting, Brad says, "What are you going to say? What have you prepared?" "I hadn't prepared anything, so I said, I'll just wing it." He now had a pretty good idea why Brad had given him a new job title. My role was to walk around and say to clients, "Don't you understand you're being fucked?" The man on the other end of this first extemporaneous presentation, the president of a $9 billion hedge fund, recalls the encounter this way. "I know I have a $300 million problem on a $9 billion hedge fund." That is, he knows that the cost of not being able to trade at the stated market prices is costing him $300 million a year. "But I don't know exactly what the problem is." As he's talking, I'm saying to myself, RBC doesn't even know what they are doing. And who are these guys? They aren't traders. They're not sales guys. And they're not quants. So what are they? And then they say they have a solution to the world's problems. And you're like, "What? How on earth can I even trust you?" And then they totally explain my problem. Between them, Brad and Ronan told this hedge fund manager all they had learned. They explained, in short, how the informational value of everything this man did with money was being auctioned by brokers and exchanges to high-frequency trading firms so that they might exploit him. That was why he had a $300 million problem on a $9 billion fund. After Brad and Ronan had left his office, the president of this big hedge fund, who had never before thought of himself as prey, reconsidered the financial markets. He sat at his desk, watching both his personal online brokerage account and his $1,800 a month Bloomberg terminal. In his private brokerage account, he set out to buy an exchange-traded fund, ETF, comprised of Chinese construction companies. Over several hours, he watched the price of the fund on his Bloomberg terminal. It was midnight in China, nothing was happening, and the ETF's price didn't budge. He then clicked the buy button on his online brokerage account screen, and the price on the Bloomberg screen jumped. Most people who used online brokerage accounts didn't have Bloomberg terminals that enabled them to monitor the market in something close to real time. Most investors never would know what happened in the market after they pressed the buy button. "I hadn't even hit execute," says the hedge fund president. "I hadn't done anything but put in a ticker symbol and a quantity to buy, and the market popped." Then, after he had bought his ETF at a higher price than originally listed, the hedge fund president received a confirmation saying that the trade had been executed by Citadel Derivatives. Citadel was one of the biggest high-frequency trading firms, and I wondered, why is my online broker sending my trades to Citadel? Brad had observed and encouraged a lot of Wall Street careers, but as he said, "I'd never seen anyone's star rise as quickly as Ronan's did. He just took off." Ronan, for his part, couldn't quite believe how ordinary the people on Wall Street were. "It's a whole industry of bullshit," he said. The first thing that struck Ronan about a lot of the big investors he met was their insecurity. "People in this industry don't want to admit they don't know something," he said. "Almost never do they say, 'No, I don't know, tell me.' I'd say, 'Do you know what co-location is?' And they'd say, 'Oh yeah, I know about co-location.' Then I'd say, 'You know, HFT now puts their servers in the same building with the exchange, as close as possible to the exchange's matching engine, so they get market data before everyone else.' And people are like, 'What the fuck? That's gotta be illegal.' We met with hundreds of people, and no one knew about it." He was also surprised to find how wedded they were to the big Wall Street banks, even when those banks failed them. "In HFT, there was no loyalty whatsoever," he said. Over and over again, investors would tell Ronan and Brad how outraged they were that the big Wall Street firms that handled their stock market orders had failed to protect them from this new predator. Yet they were willing to give RBC only a small percentage of their trades to execute. "This was the biggest confusion to me about Wall Street," said Ronan.
"Wait, you're telling me you can't pay us because you need to pay all these other people who are trying to screw you?"
Maybe because Ronan was so unlike a Wall Street person, he was granted special access and was able to get inside the heads of the Wall Street people to whom he spoke. "After that first meeting, I told him there was no point in us even being in the same meeting," said Brad. "We needed to divide and conquer." By the end of 2010, Brad and Ronan, between them, met with roughly 500 professional stock market investors who controlled, among them, many trillions of dollars in assets. They never created a PowerPoint. They never did anything more formal than sit down and tell people everything they knew in plain English. Brad soon realized that the most sophisticated investors didn't know what was going on in their own market. Not the big mutual funds, Fidelity and Vanguard. Not the big money management firms like T. Rowe Price and Janus Capital. Not even the most sophisticated hedge funds. The legendary investor David Einhorn, for example, was shocked. So was Dan Loeb, another prominent hedge fund manager. Bill Ackman ran a famous hedge fund, Pershing Square, that often made bids for large chunks of companies. In the 2 years before Brad turned up in his office to explain what was happening, Ackman had started to suspect that people might be using the information about his trades to trade ahead of him. "I felt that there was a leak every time," says Ackman. "I thought maybe it was the prime broker. It wasn't the kind of leak that I thought." A salesman Brad hired at RBC from Merrill Lynch to help him market Thor recalls one big investor calling to say, "You know, I thought I knew what I did for a living, but apparently not, because I had no idea this was going on." Then came the so-called flash crash. At 2:45 on May 6, 2010, for no obvious reason, the market fell 600 points in a few minutes. A few minutes later, like a drunk trying to pretend he hadn't just knocked over the fish bowl and killed the pet goldfish, it bounced right back up to where it was before. If you weren't watching closely, you could have missed the entire event. Unless, of course, you had placed orders in the market to buy or sell certain stocks. Shares of Procter & Gamble, for instance, traded as low as a penny and as high as $100,000. 20,000 different trades happened at stock prices more than 60% removed from the prices of those stocks just moments before. 5 months later, the SEC published a report blaming the entire fiasco on a single large sell order of stock market futures contracts mistakenly placed on an exchange in Chicago by an obscure Kansas City mutual fund. That explanation could only be true by accident, because the stock market regulators did not possess the information they needed to understand the stock markets. The unit of trading was now the microsecond, but the records kept by the exchanges were by the second. There were 1 million microseconds in a second. It was as if, back in the 1920s, the only stock market data available was a crude aggregation of all trades made during the decade. You could see that at some point in that era, there had been a stock market crash. You could see nothing about the events on and around October 29, 1929. The first thing Brad noticed as he read the SEC report on the flash crash was its old-fashioned sense of time. "I did a search of the report for the word minute," said Brad. "I got 87 hits. I then searched for second and got 63 hits. I then searched for millisecond and got 4 hits. None of them actually relevant. Finally, I searched for microsecond and got 0 hits." He read the report once and then never looked at it again. Once you get a sense of the speed with which things are happening, you realize that explanations like this, someone hitting a button, are not right, he said. You want to see a single time-stamped sheet of every trade to see what followed from what. Not only does it not exist, it can't exist.